you don't inspire growth by pretending that you're perfect. And those leaders or that leadership type create a culture where pretending matters more than learning. And I've seen this a gazillion times where, you know, curiosity dies, collaboration dries up, innovation stalls because no one feels safe admitting they don't know something. And,
right,
you know, if you're going to lead with your ego in the driver's seat and then think that I don't know makes you look weak or makes someone else look weak, then the irony is that they're really faking it. It's just faking. It's making them actually, those who are in tune see right through that. And when you're faking confidence, you're really showing your vulnerability and you look insecure. And then your staff, when they are on the receiving end of that, are like, what's going on? I don't understand this. But they fear losing control more than they value growth. So they perform confidence instead of building competence. And that's the key. And that's where people, and you know, when you think about it, Pierre, from that perspective, that's not leadership, that's theater.
Welcome to Insight is Capital. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. Today's guest is none other than Mark Robinson. Yep, the guy who proudly calls himself the shitty leadership guy. He's built an entire career around helping, that is what I said, the shitty leadership guy. He's built an entire career around helping leaders be a little less, well, shitty. After spending 30 years in the wild world of leadership, Mark's pretty much seen it all. The micromanagers who treat check-ins like parole hearings, the buzzword addicts who think synergy solves everything, and the ego-driven bosses who confuse fear with respect. Rather than just pointing fingers, Mark turned the mirror on himself. He realized he'd had his own share of not-so-great leadership moments and decided to do something about it. The result? A no BS approach to leadership coaching that mixes sharp wit, brutal honesty, and just enough tough love to shake people out of their management coma. He's the brain behind The Ego Continuum and its follow-up, The Ego Continuum 2, two must-reads for any leader who's brave enough to admit they might be part of the problem. Think of them as survival guides for anyone trapped in the cycle of ego, insecurity, and awkward team huddles. Mark's mission is clear. Help leaders, and for the sake of our conversation here today, to help advisors cut the crap, get real with themselves, and lead like actual humans. No fluff, no jargon, just a straight shot of reality with a chaser of humor. If you've ever found yourself silently screaming in a meeting, wondering, is it me? Or is this whole system broken? Mark's here to help you correct course. Pants optional.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Mark, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us and being on the show.
Thank you. That's by far the best introduction I've ever heard. I love that. Well done.
Excited for our conversation today.
Likewise, me too.
Mark, before we begin, I know I talked about, you know, I've already introduced you, but please tell us a little bit about yourself from your perspective, your career background, and what precipitated your bold move into your current incarnation?
You know, I get asked that all the time, and I love it because it keeps me grounded in my own ability to reflect on where I came from. And I was just having this conversation a few days ago with a group of more junior leaders wondering about, you know, where I got started. And many, many, many years ago, the short story long is, you know, I worked for an organization where they had me. My background is in contact centers across all industries. And I was hired to do HR. So I hired like 300 people in the call center. And then they wanted me to become a supervisor in the call center. So I was like, oh, I could do that with my eyes closed. I had some background, but not the experience I have today. Anyway, I was so not the right fit. I got the job and was watching what my peers were doing and how they were talking about KPIs and trending and really honing in on real true coaching and support of their staff to build and change outcomes. And I was sitting back wondering when lunch was. and you know, not and like going to a team meeting with my manager and all of my peers and thinking, I need to step it up or I need to find another job because I'm clearly not doing what I should be doing. And that was the wake-up call that I didn't know I needed. And so it was really about, you know, now it's Welcome to Leadership. It's no longer about you. How do you course correct your own behavior to support your staff, to give them what they need? And it just, Pierre, grew from there. It grew from, you know, now 4 books in, coaching and public speaking and just really trying to help people with a touch of humor to really help them reflect on where they are so that they can better support other people or their clients. And of course, all of this stems outside of the work environment because, you know, if you're a shitty leader at work, there's probably some stuff coming home with you as well. Maybe we'll see. We'll figure that out, right? But, you know, so it's just, you know, adults talking to adults in real, honest conversations. And I'll point out to your listeners that if I say anything that makes you cringe, it's probably because you need to hear it.
I've had my share of moments as well where I just sort of sat back and said, you know, why am I trying to accomplish things the way I am? And you know, when this other way would be so much easier. Let's start with the Dunning-Kruger fantasy, also known as the confident, loud, painfully wrong advisor and leader. In a business where trust is everything, Mark, what happens when a leader treats humility like a weakness and thinks that something like Googling is cheating?
Well, for those that don't know the Dunning-Kruger effect, it is basically when leaders inflate their own skill sets. That's the short version, where you think you're a rock star and you're actually not even a backup dancer. And you really have to find the wherewithal and the courage to be able to look inside and say, you know, am I truly the rock star I think I am? And so some of the areas to think about in humility and those, you know, leaders who treat it like it's a weakness, you know, you don't inspire growth by pretending that you're perfect. And those leaders or that leadership type create a culture where pretending matters more than learning. And I've seen this a gazillion times where, you know, curiosity dies, collaboration dries up, innovation stalls because no one feels safe admitting they don't know something. And,
right,
you know, if you're going to lead with your ego in the driver's seat and then think that I don't know makes you look weak or makes someone else look weak, then the irony is that they're really faking it. It's just faking. It's making them actually, those who are in tune see right through that. And when you're faking confidence, you're really showing your vulnerability and you look insecure. And then your staff, when they are on the receiving end of that, are like, what's going on? I don't understand this. But they fear losing control more than they value growth. So they perform confidence instead of building competence. And that's the key. And that's where people, and you know, when you think about it, Pierre, from that perspective, that's not leadership, that's theater. I love saying that. I can't tell you how much I love saying that. But it sucks. And it sucks because you end up with a team that's too afraid to ask or explore or challenge anything. And then people waste time pretending instead of improving. You know, it's like you're in a meeting and everyone's fake smiling going, yeah, it's fine. No, it's fine. I'm not upset. What are you talking about? I'm fine. Can't you see how fine I am? It's that kind of stuff, right? And the best talent quickly checks out or worst case walks out. And so leaders pretend to know everything, make others afraid, and then they make others afraid to ask questions, which then creates this level of uncertainty. And this leads to rework, wasted time, lost innovation, and you know, these illusions going on about people faking leadership and faking confidence instead of actually having that psychologically safe or psychologically brave space to actually stand up and say, I got no idea what we're talking about here, so can someone bring me in? And, you know, if you're the leader and if you reflect on this from what you're hearing now, if you starve curiosity by turning every question into a personal threat, what is that actually doing to the people that you're technically supposed to be supporting? And so really to sort of sum up this, if you think about real leaders learn out loud. And if I don't know makes you flinch, you're not a leader, you're a liability. And I know people listening know what a liability is. And you inspire it. The way to change it is you inspire it by modeling the behavior and the outcomes you want. So you model curiosity, you model honesty, you model the courage to keep learning out loud and in front of your team. I love saying, you remember Workopolis, the job site that was right. Commercial, I think in the 90s, where, you know, the female boss is telling the employee, you know this stuff better than I do. That's why I've put you on this assignment. And I love saying that to my team. And it's true. When you're at a senior level and you're the strategist and you have a bunch of folks that are, you know, that you're supporting that are in the day-to-day grind, they're going to know a hell of a lot more than you are about the day-to-day grind. So remind them of that, because I don't need to learn it. I need to know how to support it. And that's the difference.
I recall, you know, on a lighter note, sitting across from clients explaining things and not really giving any thought at that moment. Like if I look back on that moment in time, you know, you said something about theater, and you know, when you're in a role where you know sales matters, where your imperative is to close business and bring on a new client, there's a danger of being overly performative, like going through your script of you know how you onboard a client, how you know what you feel like you must say to every single client. And you know, I look back, and it was dozens and dozens of times I had the same, if not more, where I was so in my channel that, you know, if I put myself now in hindsight in the client's seat listening to me, I'm feeling like I really want to ask a stupid question, but I don't want to ask the stupid question because I don't want to look stupid.
Yep.
And that, I think the same thing happens also with leaders and their teams, advisors and their teams, their assistants, which is that, you know, they say something verbatim and then the assistant or the teammate doesn't want to step on that imperative, because they don't want to sound foolish or stupid or not in tune.
Yeah.
And even if, you know, the most, so coming back full circle to your point, like maybe after you've said what you want to say, maybe you turn around and say, well, what are your thoughts, John? Or what are your thoughts, Mary? Like, what do you think about this? But sincerely, not trying to, you know, ask someone a question so that you can out their real thoughts. That's only going to happen once or twice. And then after that, those people are going to clam up because
sure.
They're not going to fall for that trap again. But if you genuinely ask, you know, what are your thoughts? What do you think we should do? How do you think we should proceed? What's the best way to do this? Or how do you think about it? How do you think about this problem? And actually eliciting or, you know, feedback from their team members.
For sure.
For real.
That's,
you know, really eliciting feedback the same way they should also do that with clients, would go a long way to resolving that Dunning-Kruger effect of being,
absolutely,
of hubris and potentially causing yourself as a leader, a problem of hubris, being overconfident and marching forward without taking into consideration all of the important things from the other side of the table.
There's it's a very valid point, and we see it all the time, but we only see it if we're open to see it during interactions. And, you know, in a group setting, there'll be some people who'll be terrified to say anything because of fear of looking dumb, but that's in their head. No one's making them feel dumb. That's just an insecurity where you got to find that inner barometer to say, I know what everyone's talking about, and I'm going to ask a question. And if it's a stupid question, then we'll laugh about it and move on. Life doesn't change because you ask a stupid question, but what does change is the growth that you took and the risk that you took and the chance that you took to ask something through your confidence that might make you vulnerable, because that's where growth changes. And that's where growth and people on the perimeter that's in your meeting or the people that you're conversing with will be like, you know, it takes courage to do that. It takes courage to stand up and say, hey, you know, no one likes to be the center of attention unless you're naturally the center of attention. And I totally get that. It's two-way conversation, and you're, you know, eliciting that feedback, and you're trying to have a conversation that's two-way. If it's not a two-way conversation, then it's a monologue, and then we go back to the performance thing, right? So you want to have that dialogue. What are your thoughts? You know, do you see this differently? What should we do differently? What are some other areas we should discuss that are similar to this? Or what have you found worked before? Those kinds of probing questions are going to elicit that collaboration and less of the, look at me, I'm the best leader in the world and I have all the answers. It's great when you're like, I have a team, I want to talk to you about this. I really want to get your thoughts on this. Let me tell you what your thoughts are. And then you don't shut up and give the person 2 seconds to think of what they want to say, because they've all been trained to be actively listening. So they're not thinking of their response. They're listening to you. People fear the pause and then they just keep talking again. I'm like, don't fear the pause. The pause is good. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, like the advisory business is, for example, more often than not, I'm not saying all advisors have this issue, but it's a very egotistical business. It's very high conviction driven. So there's a risk of imposing a high conviction view on, at whether it's your clients or imposing a high conviction view on your team. And this is, you know, it's my way or it's the highway. This is how we're going to do things, as opposed to what we just talked about. And speaking of egos, speaking of egos, yes, there's the ego sponge, the glory hog by day and scapegoat artist by night.
Yep.
How exactly does this leadership parasite suck the oxygen out of a team and leave them gasping for air?
So it sounds like leaders that, you know, they have tons of ideas but no follow through. And, you know, I guess from that lens, you know, you can't lead a strategy if your plan changes every Tuesday. And, you know...
Yeah.
And we've all been, you laugh because you've been there. I get it.
Yeah.
I'm very familiar with those laughs because, you know, I say things and sometimes it's that laugh, and that laugh is that recognition that I have experienced exactly what you're saying. And, you know, there are some shitty leaders out there who love to create chaos disguised as creativity. And then what you're left with is your teams get whiplash from these constant pivots, priorities blur, and nothing actually gets done except burnout. And people saying, what am I doing here?
Wait a second. I thought we were doing A. Now we're doing B, or now we're doing D. Like, what happened?
The teams don't get paid. Your staff don't get paid to chase shiny objects. Instead of doing focused work, and you know this will confuse energy with execution, and the love of that high of brainstorming. But then they generally will ghost when there's the follow through part. And I'm like, you know, and when you think about that from a leadership perspective, that's a very classic shitty leadership behavior that can help people think about, have I been on the receiving end of that or do I do that? Yeah. And all of this ends up here chalking up to, like, going back to the theater analogy, is it becomes performative leadership. It's not productive leadership. It's actually working harder, not smarter, because the byproduct of this is the teams are always starting, but never finishing. And it is an absolute morale killer. People stop believing anything that will stick, you know, and, you know, doing a Friday pizza lunch isn't going to solve that when you now have your 10th time starting something that never got off to fruition. And then behind closed doors, some of those same staff get yelled at saying, why is the project not moving forward? You have 10 priority ones that keep failing and not starting and changing every week. Scope creep. We all know what that means.
Yeah.
You end up with chaos, confusion, and a whole lot of wasted time. And wasted time is rework. And I hate rework. And most non-shitty leaders hate rework because it's affecting your bottom line. You know, so if your to-do list is just last week's ideas collecting dust, then congratulations, you've built a theater company. It's not a team. It's performative. Again, we're going to use a lot of theater analogies today, I have a feeling. You know, and nobody wants to work for a walking whiteboard of half-baked concepts. And that's what it ends up feeling like. And so, you know, for those listening, if you've seen this movie before, what we're talking about, constant changes in direction never follows through. Lots of brainstorming, little action. Plans are made, but never executed. And the thing about all of this is that ideas are cheap, Execution is leadership. And if you're stuck in that cycle of hype with no follow through, the problem isn't innovation. The problem is you. You don't just inspire. Leaders don't just inspire. You also have to commit, deliver, and finish. It's not rocket science.
Yeah, so
you think about it, but it's taking it to that next level, right?
So if you're sitting there wondering why your team is disillusioned or not taking any initiative,
look in the mirror.
And only and only waiting for instructions to be trotted out. That is time to look in the mirror, as you said. I think the other thing is you know, it also causes a kind of, you know, problem where it trickles down, because what happens is that the constant change in directions and instructions or directives coming from the advisor, the leader of the team, means that important things might not get done for clients because directions got changed midstream, you know, the next day, the next week. And a month out, you know, maybe the advisor's looking at the team member and saying, where's that report I asked you for? You know, where's that follow-up for that client I asked you for? And the team member saying, well, you know, 3 days later, you changed your mind. I mean, maybe they're not saying it to the boss, but they're saying it to themselves, 3 days later, you changed your mind.
Right.
And I thought that was off the, you know, I thought that was off the table. What are you talking about? No, I didn't. Yes, you did. and then it's, yes, you did. No, I didn't. Argument. It's very unproductive. And maybe that teammate decides, you know, I can't take this anymore. This is ridiculous. I'm being held accountable for it. Meanwhile, you're the one who told me to move on and do this other thing more importantly. So wires get crossed. Yeah.
I talk about outsourcing your accountability. And I think this is a good example of when leaders outsource their accountability. Is that, you go into these things with, you know, and shitty leaders aren't shitty people. They just sometimes make bad choices. So, you know, I don't know many shitty leaders that are sitting, you know, at their desk purposely trying to do this stuff to mess up their staff. That's what makes the reflective element of this so imperative, is that you could be doing this. Just think for a second. You could be engaging in these behaviors and not realize that you're engaging in these behaviors. And the higher up you go, the less feedback you get. And so if you haven't had a one-on-one or coaching from, you know, a senior leader, or, you know, it's not like the board's going to talk to a CEO about their feedback generally. Some might, but it's rare. So if you're not directly getting feedback that forces you to look in the mirror, then it's no wonder some of these folks that I've coached and worked with and will in the future, you know, usually within 5 minutes of talking to me, they ask me to leave their office, and then someone comes running after me to the elevator when they've taken that five. So I walk slowly on purpose so that I know they're going to come back. It's the resonation time, right? They're actually, it's sinking in, and I'm like 3, 2, 1. Hi. Okay. Let's keep talking. Yeah. So I get it. It's cringeworthy, and I know it's cringeworthy for a lot of people, but that's where growth happens. Growth doesn't come in things that are just happening regularly. You got to take that risk of leaning into that discomfort and having those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, your work is very provocative. It's very evocative as well. And I can see where it just naturally, you know, goes in that direction. The other thing I'm noticing too is, as we progress through our conversation, is that there seems to be a cascading effect. Like, you know, the first two elements we've talked about seem to just naturally dovetail into the third, which is that you end up with chaos. You end up with a very chaotic management environment where people are in disarray. The bosses, you know, the leader is in disarray. The advisor's in disarray because of the disorganization that's occurred because of their shitty leadership.
Yep.
And and the team is in disarray because they no longer know what their priorities are. You know, there's no alignment, and 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 so that leads into the chaos and the chaos generator, which is equal parts visionary. So again, as you said, you know, shady leaders aren't shady people. They may also be great visionaries, but in
really
the course of doing that, yeah, there's a tornado that is there as well, right? There's equal parts visionary, tornado, and compliance nightmare. And you know, I can't think of any advisor who actually wants to create a self-generated or an auto-generated compliance nightmare. That's by far the most that's like the biggest encumbrance to any advisory practice is compliance, and causing these types of you know, this confluence of events to take place in management where you end up at a standstill. So what happens when your so-called leader has 100 ideas, but zero follow through, and treats that structure like it's toxic waste? Like what? I know we touched on some of that already, but like,
yeah, I think that part of what I'm getting, where my mind is going is more along the lines of, I guess I would call it control freak behavior.
Right.
And when the control freak confuses overwork with effectiveness, and I think we've seen a lot of this, or this does absolutely dovetail in what we were talking about. So if we look on the playing field of micromanagement, what is micromanagement? It's just fear pretending to be excellence, right? When you think about it.
Right.
And because shitty leaders will equate being busy with being valuable. So if you're like, oh, I've worked 14 hours today, or I'm working Saturday and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. So instead of leading, they micromanage, they hoard tasks, they burn out and trying to do it all better, but then leaving the team dispowered and disengaged. And the shitty leadership concept of that is that why do leaders do this? Because I can't trust anyone other than myself. I'm not trusting you with this, but then I kind of need you to do some of it, but I'm going to watchdog every last piece of this in order to get what I think I need without just telling your staff what you need them to do and being clear and concise in your direction. So they built their worth around being the smartest and the hardest worker in the room, and letting go to them feels like losing control or credibility. And the spoiler alert, Pierre, on that is that it's neither. It just sucks. It sucks because it bottlenecks progress, because everything needs their hands on it. Their team stopped trying because what's the point if nothing's ever good enough? So why would you keep killing yourself to do the analytics and to prepare the presentation and to set up the appointments when you're either going to get ignored or yelled at for doing something that you had no direction on doing? There was no clear, concise direction. You tried your best to get it, or like we talked about in the last question, it kept changing because the strategy every Tuesday changed to something different. But then this builds resentment, mistakes will pile up, and this is when companies lose their A players. This is a big, big, huge, massive connection to how burnout can become contagious, because it just goes back to the whole concept that, you know, if you're doing everything yourself in leadership, it's ego in a cape. You know, and I've had many internal laugh moments where I'm either meeting people or I'm presenting something or I'm coaching someone, and it's in the initial early days and I hear the words they're choosing to use and I see the interactions with their team, and you know,
right.
I've honed my skills enough to understand that I can meet someone in a short amount of time and understand whether they're a macro or a micromanager just by the words they choose to use. And if your team can't move without your approval, then you're not managing, you're suffocating. And there comes a time where you can keep, you know, theoretically cutting off the oxygen supply, but people are going to push you out of the way and they're going to move on to where the breath is, the air is fresher and they can breathe easier. So they're not going to stay under that very long. And that's usually the final stage, working for a shitty leader for a period of time, and you've reached your internal threshold where you're like, I'm done, I'm out, see you later, bye. And it's funny, in a lot of folks that I've coached and surveys and research that I've done, you know, the byproduct of reaching your capacity of working under a shitty leader, you know, it's people will leave a job before they even have another one. if they're in a position to do so. They will find a job of, they will take a job of lesser pay to get away from working for a shitty leader. I've done it. And I know other people who have done it, and I've coached people who have done it. There you go. So
this latest segment of our conversation, the things we're talking about right now, they're very resonant with me. Mm. And, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with entrepreneurship. You know, when you start a business, you start it very minimally, like, you know, bootstrap, mm-hmm. right? You're tending, you're having, unless you have capital to start that business, you have to do all of the, you have to fill all the roles that entails,
right?
That the business itself entails. And so I think it's, my guess is that this is sort of the curse of all entrepreneurs is that you start out in you know, completely in control of your time, yourself, your attitude, your ability, your accomplishments, your awareness of every single role in the business.
Absolutely.
And then the difficulty is, you know, I have to, you know, admit it's a difficulty that I have, which is letting go of,
sure,
you know, and trusting in teammates, team members,
yep,
to take over. Like if I could duplicate myself 10 times easily, I mean, and do it easily, I would, because then I'd be able to step away more often. Mm-hmm. As long as I want, you know, and I find that's a problem that I have. And it's, you know, some of it is just, you know, wanting to make sure that everything goes the way
you want it.
I expect it to go and want it to go.
Right.
And the fear of it not going that way. So, you know, and I always have this, I have this, you know, this saying is, be careful what you fear, it will find you.
And it does.
It will, you know, it will find you. And it's the law of intention, right? It's whatever you're thinking about, whether it's negative or positive, it's going to fall in your lap. It's going to, you know, you're going to have to face it head on.
Well, it's fantastic that you have, you know, the vulnerability and the openness to share that as a personal anecdote. It's also really interesting because when I think about, you know, letting go, so real leadership means letting go. If you're the smartest or the busiest person in every room, then it's a bit of a failure at building a team worth trusting. And I have found in my research and my coaching, in certain workshops, that when the shitty leader I don't go and tell people, guess what, you're a shitty leader. I have a conversation, they figure it out. They're like, yes, oh my God, I am a shitty leader. Let's have a conversation about it. And then the magic happens and we start the process. And so when that self-revelation is made and I start to get the true feedback and the masks are off and the illusions have gone away and it's now raw, deep, vulnerable, and they're ready and they're leaning into it, the whole fear of letting go comes back to, I thought I was so busy and I didn't want to waste my time training someone else to do something that I just know that I can do on my own.
Absolutely.
And so it's finding the time and finding the right people, because if you find the right person who you can tell, and I'll never forget this, somebody, an ex-mentor of mine years ago, well, not an ex-mentor, a mentor that mentored me a while ago, had said, and I'm going to paraphrase. So he said to me, Mark, any schmuck could do a great job if I give them 80% of the data I need in order to finish the project. Impress me by me giving you 20 or 30% with the same outcome. And I can't tell you, that was probably close to 30 years ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday. Because, and it's the art of delegation. It's the art of effective leadership. It's the art of effective communication. Here's the plan. Let's collaborate. I'm going to tell you, though, this is why we're doing this. This is what we need to do. The how you're going to do it, I'm going to leave it up to you, but I need you to be at this point by this time frame. Does that make sense? What more do you need? How can I help support you in this? So then I send them on their way. And within a few days, when you're at the 10% completion mark, circle back with me and let's realign one last time for 10 minutes to make sure my vision is now in your head and it's now your vision. I'm going to tell you the what. I'm not going to tell you the how, because if I told you the how, I would just do it myself.
Yeah. Right, right.
Simple when you think about it, right? So control like that kills growth. You know, share the load and prepare to carry the consequences alone. And that's really what it is. You have no one else to blame if you're going to do it all. But what I've seen multiple times is those conversations don't happen. And I remember years ago, there were six of us on a project and the head shitty leader came in and we were presenting the deck that we had produced, all based on what he had asked us to do. And within 5 minutes, he stood up, he threw papers. This is shit. This is awful. This is nothing what I asked for. And someone had the courage to stand up and say, this is based on what you told us you wanted. Has the scope changed? If it has, let us know and we'll course correct.
Yeah.
He didn't like that.
Well, let's talk about micromanagement and why that's such a sort of deleterious thing to do with you know, team members.
It just stifles everything. There's, you know, when I take on a new team or I have a new coaching client or, you know, I'm working with an organization to help their leadership, when I'm meeting with people for the first time, I ask two questions. And this is straight out of my first book, Shameless Plug. And I ask two questions that I created. So number one is, how do you like to be led? And number two,
nothing to be shameful about, Mark. There, your books are terrific. They're straightforward, very, very easy to relate to.
So. Then it's just a plug.
There you go.
There you go. How do you like to be led, and how do you like to receive feedback? And most people, the first thing that will come out is like, oh, I've never been asked that before. And I'm like, I know, it's good, right? You know, and then I might say I wrote it. So, you know, whatever, pat on the back. But we start to engage in a conversation that's usually very different for most employees that are reporting to a leader. And if they've reported to a shitty leader, then all of a sudden they're reporting to someone who asks questions like that. It can be completely overwhelming. And so, for example, how do you like to be led? Well, I've never been asked that before. Well, what do you think it means? You know, what do you look for in a leader? What are the skills that a leader can do that stop you from staying up at night or help you show you that there's a psychological and brave space where you can manage up, you can say no, you can have open conversations, you can disagree. And so usually what comes out of that conversation is nobody wants to be micromanaged. I think everybody says that. And then I ask, what's micromanaging to you?
Yeah.
And you heard me say earlier, to me, micromanaging is just fear of pretending to be excellence. And, you know, if I'm, you know, it's like nurturing somebody that doesn't want to be nurtured. And so, you know, it's that repetitive cycle conversation. Are you okay? Yes. Are you okay now? Yes. Are you still okay? Shut up. Go away. You know, like you get to that point where it's like, I'm not asking for help. And it's not because I fear you. It's because you were really clear in what you asked me to do. And now I'm just going ahead and doing it. So if you trust me enough, where you're more on the macro side of leadership, of that leadership barometer, then give me the direction. I'm comfortable with you now because I know it's a safe space where I can say, let me just clarify what you're looking for. You know, this report Tuesday like this, or meet with these three clients by this date and do this. You know, whatever it is you're talking about, it doesn't matter. But are you as the leader being clear, and have you checked for understanding to make sure that the person you're speaking with gets what you're saying? And do you have the managerial courage to shut up and let them do it, knowing that you've both aligned, there's been collaboration, you're both on the same page, now let them go and do the work and forget about it and go and do your next thing. Because if you keep worrying about what the other person's doing, you got X number of other people here that are feeling neglected. But if you keep wanting to circle back, can I get an update on this? Why are you asking for an update when you gave them a week to do it? You know, like if you need a week update, then put that as the barometer check that update me weekly. Just send me a note on Microsoft Teams or Slack, you know, let me know how it's going, or, you know, but be clear in what you're asking for. But then when you start to realize what you're asking, you got to look in the mirror and say, have I been clear in these directions? Have I been super clear with what I look, with what I'm looking for? You know, there's a icebreaker exercise that I'm sure you've heard of and that I'm sure your listeners have seen before, which is you have two people and one's standing at an easel ready to draw and the other person's back. So the person that has the sheet of paper in their hand with something they want them to draw or construct, they're giving direction on what the other person has to draw. And most times, as they're going through it, you really start to understand the element of clear direction, because the drawing on the paper and the drawing on the easel generally look nothing alike. Right. And another example is years ago when I was recruiting for adult learners, we would always, as the final interview stage, we would always have them do a presentation and teach us something. And a lot of people, one of the ones that we loved, because we'd always give them the same task, so you'd have three or four people coming in, and you see the variance in how, with the creativity in what people do. So give an example, show me a visual example of how to tie shoelaces. And so people would say, well, you take the shoe and you make a bow. I'm like, how do I make a bow out of a shoe? I don't know what that means. You're not clear enough. Or mm-hmm. people are saying, do this. Or you're driving in a car and you're driving and the passenger beside you says, look at that tree. There's 72,000 trees that I just saw. Which one particular are you talking about? Or, oh my God, look at that cloud. I'm like, which cloud? So most people, I'll be honest, in the whether you're a shitty leader or not, think they're being clear and they're not. They don't take that level of communication to that specific level where they're actually clearly saying from a direction in a work environment, this is the output I need you to do. This is when I need it by. Do you understand? Do you know what we need to do? Is it clear? How can I help? And if people just took that little bit of extra time, micromanagement would dissipate big time in most of the in most businesses.
Yeah,
and I personally think it's getting a little worse. From what I've seen, it's getting worse. New generations of leadership that haven't been trained in a way that is clear in their communication.
Well, yeah, I mean, this would be a great primer for you know, younger adults coming into the workforce and understanding, you know, how fluid things can be, and you know, how to navigate that. And like,
yes,
it's such a, you know, there's a dynamic that's very hard to understand when you're just fresh out of school and you're entering the workforce. You know, we tell our kids, you know, you need to go and get a job. You need to go and get a job and feel the pain of and the triumph of both.
Right.
You need to feel the pain and the glory of working in a job for someone you don't know, not
right.
You know, and you know, I just want to go back because I really like your questions for the team, which is, you know, how do you want to be led? How do you want to be managed? But I want to adapt that for the advisor client relationship. And I know, you know, we talked about this in our past conversations, and that question is equally provocative.
Yes.
How do you want to be advised?
Yes. Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Because you have to look past your ego where, you know, you are a successful advisor and you think, you know, this is the way I do things. This is how I've always done it. This is how I'm going to do it for you. And instead of doing that, how about take a step back and ask the client, you know, how do you want to be advised? What are your, you know, rather than asking even a common question, which is what are your expectations? That's a very open-ended question. But I think actually asking somebody, like asking the team, how do you want to be led? Asking a client the same question, but in the sense of, you know, in the framework of, or the context of advice, how do you want to be advised? Because every single client is another individual. And in fact, the irony of it is that you know, the advisor and the client are actually on the same level of management. They're both leaders. The client is the leader because the client is bringing the assets to the advisor.
Yes.
And the advisor is the leader because the advisor is going to provide leadership guidance on portfolio, financial planning, estate planning, tax planning, all of the different value propositions that advisors bring to the table. But
yes.
But to actually I'm just thinking, how constructive is that? That is such a constructive way to make your client realize, like, by inference and by implication,
yes,
I am treating you as my equal, not as somebody that is just my client.
And if we go back to fear from your first question, for most, general public, if they're going to a financial advisor for the first time, there's probably going to be a fear. There's probably going to be an intimidation level. There could be that, I'm not going to know what this means, or I'm not going to know what that means, and I'm going to look stupid, and they're going to take advantage of me. And so if an advisor goes in to that profile of a potential customer then and asks, what are your expectations? If they're honest, they're going to say, I don't know, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But if they get asked that about what are your expectations, that could drive the fear down. But if they went in and did their version of my two questions, how do you want to be advised? What are you hoping to achieve? What are you looking for? What's your level of knowledge? And they go in with that level of openness to be able to really create that same level. Then I think that, if General Joe client was, interviewing, a bunch of financial advisors to pick one, most people would go with the one who created the feeling that I can trust you and I want to work with you. And I'm not going to just say, we're going to do this and invest all your money here and you're going to like it. I want to know truly what you're looking for and what your expectations are and what your needs are. And how can I better manage myself to better manage you? Someone said that to me, that's the person I go with.
I put myself in the client's shoes when I was thinking about it. I didn't come up with this idea of asking a client, how do you want to be advised, in a vacuum. It was from our conversations, Mark.
Yes.
You actually inspired it. But I just want to give credit where credit's due. But, I just think if I'm a client and I'm asked, how do you want to be advised?
Yeah.
How do you want to be advised? To me, that is a deeply provocative question.
That's a golden
in a very positive and constructive way. Like, the implications of that question is I'm making you the leader. Like, that the advisor is basically implying I'm putting you in the hot seat. I'm putting you in the leadership seat.
Yeah.
Along with the role you expect from me. So that you imply collaboration, you imply empowerment. I'm going to take guidance from you as well as you expect me to give you guidance on the areas you aren't knowledgeable about.
Yeah.
I expect you to give me guidance on what you need me to know about you.
It's leveling the playing field that if somebody's going to an advisor, it's because they need it. They need an advisor.
It's so powerful for both. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, Mark.
No, no.
It's so powerful for both the team and the client. The team to be asked your two questions and the client to be asked that question and whatever the ensuing questions are. Absolutely. From that conversation. Because I imagine that the conversation with the client would go very far. Because suddenly the client feels like, wow, this is really, not what I expected. I definitely didn't expect to be asked that question. Mm-hmm. You're asking me to tell you exactly what my specific intentions are, expectations are, and how I see the world where our relationship is concerned. And I think, just implementing, like, if you want something, a takeaway from our conversation today,
that's one of
implement that question. When you bring on a new hire and you and re-onboard your existing team.
Yes.
Right? With that same question. You know, I'm changing things. I want to know this. How do you expect to be led? How do you expect me to manage you? Because it implies a lot of initiative as well. I mean, in addition to leadership, collaboration.
Absolutely.
You know, you tell me. And I think...
Yeah.
I think, yeah, you're going to have clients who are just going to turn around and say, I have no idea. But maybe in that immediate response to that question, but maybe a day later,
if
they thought about it, you know, that reflection, like you said, I walk slowly. I walk slow out of the meeting because I know, like, 3, 2, 1, here it comes. Right.
99.
Wait a second. I've thought about your question you know, but what a great onboarding, what a great sort of initializing question to open up a relationship.
When we don't lead from our ego, and when we consciously know we're not leading from our ego, this is when these magical conversations happen. And that's really it. You know, I'm a big shot investor, and I'm a big shot analyst, and, you know, advisor, and I'm going to come and tell you my portfolio, and I'm going to tell you all my successful clients, and you should use me. Why wouldn't you? Look at how awesome I am. You know, that might appeal to some, but it's not going to appeal to everybody. But if you're more, this is what I've done for other people. This is what, we might be able to do this for you, but what do you want? That's a different conversation,
more importantly,
and a different opening.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And finally, Mark, that brings us to the passive pretender, the smooth talker, zero backbone. You know, why are some of the nicest leaders also the absolute worst at making decisions that matter?
So I would look at that as the one, the leader that tries to be everybody's buddy, that approach.
Right.
Yeah. So if your team likes you but doesn't respect you, that's not leadership, Pierre, that's babysitting. And these leaders trade respect for popularity. Boundaries will blur, accountability dies, and decisions get delayed, all to avoid hurt feelings or the perception of hurt feelings or having any form of managerial courage to engage in those difficult conversations. And so saying, let's chat, that alone can incite an employee from a leader to be like, oh, like it's funny when you be like, hey, do you got a minute? Can we chat? What did I do wrong? Like, why is the perception of feedback always an F word? That's what blows my mind, is that people lose sight. When I say I'm going to give you feedback, everyone automatically is prone and programmed to automatically go, what have I done wrong? And that's because leaders don't spend enough time telling our staff what they've done well, what they've done great, what we're proud of them for doing. And they think that conflict, because they think that conflict is a failure. Conflict, like, people are like, how many people have you ever talked to that have said, oh, I don't like confrontation, I stay away from it? Well, you got to change your barometer of what confrontation means. Because confrontation isn't always fists up and you're going to have an argument and see who can use, you know, the worst profanity at each other. Who can do the best name calling? That's sure, that's a form of confrontation. But confrontation can also mean engaging in a difficult conversation with one of your employees that has repeatedly showed behavior that is counterproductive, that you as the leader want to course correct to create a different outcome. That's a difficult conversation, and that's a form of confrontation, but you don't have to be a shitty leader to do it. You can actually be a very inspiring leader. Help me understand these choices that you keep making, because we've talked about them a few times, and I really want to help you improve this area. So what do you need from me to really understand the message that this kind of stuff has to change? This is what I'd like it to look like. How do I help get you there? Or better, how do we work together to get you there? You know, and then, you know, if it continues the way that it continues with, you know, everyone's buddy-buddy, but they don't take you seriously, you know, they become addicted. Some leaders become addicted to being liked. That was me in my first job when I realized I was the shitty leader. You know, to me, it was about, where are we going for lunch? And, you know, oh, who's having a party after work? And are we getting together for drinks? Whereas my team were craving feedback and I was like, when's lunch? You know, and so they're addicted to being liked. So they avoid the tough calls. They sugarcoat feedback. Everything is great. And they confuse being liked with being trusted. And when they realize they're actually not trusted, then you've created that byproduct of what they're not doing has created a leadership identity crisis for themselves, because they don't understand why nobody wants to bring them into the serious conversations, because they're known as the fluff. You know, teams feel directionless because the teams don't feel like anyone is actually steering. Toxic behavior goes unchecked and guised under, well, I'm just keeping the peace. Or trust erodes fast and people realize that tough conversations actually never happen in the first place. And so all the mess just keeps building up and building up and building up. You know, and if you're trying to make everyone happy, is a great way to actually please no one. And, you know, leaders aren't hired to host a group hug. We're hired to actually lead, you know, when you think about it. And so leaders who avoid that tough conversation and try to please everyone actually leave their teams lost, and disrespect just grows. And the irony is that if the employees aren't self-aware to the level where they're picking up on this, they can't understand why they love John as a person, but don't go to him for help ever. And they actually start relying on others until someone clues in and says, why don't we ever go to John for this?
No.
John's a doofus sitting in his office wondering when lunch is and not actually doing anything and adding any value because he just wants to be everybody's friend. That's not leadership. But we've all worked for someone like that before, or with someone like that before, you know, and.
This is applicable to, you know, you can
planet?
This is everywhere. Like,
everywhere.
You know, this is something that you can apply. You know, you could take the words, leader and teams and replace it with parents and teens.
You could. You could.
Right. I mean, it applies to parenting as well, doesn't it? I mean, we all potentially have experienced, you know, having this happen, you know, in our formative years.
Sure.
Right. Where like I can see where the origin of wanting to be liked over wanting to be respected.
Yes. Well,
could then like follow you into adult life, into leadership.
If you're a shitty leader, you generally the people who are shitty leaders that want to be liked, and the people who are shitty leaders that already demand or think they're respected are usually two different barometers of shitty leadership. They're usually not the same, because if I am so far down ego-driven where I just think I'm amazing and you lead to me and I'm more that dictatorship, then you don't care if people like you. Like, you couldn't give a shit if people like you. But then if you're that insecure side of the leadership and less of a dictator, it's funny how there's many barometers of shitty leadership. And the ones who are more insecure and want to be liked, what ends up happening is you end up nurturing people that don't want to be nurtured. You create the parent-child mentality and infrastructure. And you got to be really careful, because if you get too parental with staff, that's when you end up crossing a line. And employees will get more offended at that than working for a dictator. Because the dictator, you know, is like a bull in a china shop. They know is rude, but they know when they come together, when the team comes together at lunch in the lunchroom and they're all going through LinkedIn looking for their next job and sharing resume tips, they know that that leader doesn't personally hate them. They just hate everybody. And so they don't take that personally, and they create coping strategies together to work for that dictator. Right. Whereas the person who's liked, once the revelation happens where they realize that they don't really add much value, the disrespect or the lack of trust, the disrespect gets even worse, where now they start fluffing them off. And they're like, can we have a meeting? Oh, I'm actually really busy right now, because they know there's going to be no value to that chat. It's all that, I need you to like me and I want you to like me. Do you like me more? I'm going to do this so that you like me. Oh, do you like me? And people are just like, oh my God, you need, you know, I think you need help in other areas of, you know, just meeting with me, because I get nothing from you as a leader. And so leaders that are more on the insecure side have to be really careful with the parent-child, because it could actually be more detrimental to those dictators who are just like, get out of my way.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a previous role where I was, you know, I reported along with my team directly, indirectly to the CEO. And, you know, I decided about maybe 2 or 3 weeks into my role as a wholesaler that I was going to approach the task my way. Mm-hmm. Right, which was, I don't care what happens at the meetings. I'm there to, I don't care specifically what happens, the outcome, I mean. I'm going to go and see the advisors that I need to go and see and get to know them and not, you know, walk in with a sharp stick to try and get them to do what I want them to do or what I've been told I have to make them, do, you know, get them on board for.
Sure.
So it started with me, and then when we onboarded an increasing team of wholesalers, you know, they came to me with meetings. They saw how I ran my meetings, and then, you know, they also had to deal with the boss, right, with the CEO, which was. Well, you know, the CEO is telling me, I'm not going to name any names, of course, but
probably better if you don't. Yeah.
You know, CEO is telling me I got to do it this way. This is what he expects from me. This is what I'm supposed to do. This is how it's got to be done.
Yes.
And I said, I said, what matters in the long run is the success of what you do, the outcome of what you do. But I don't think you should do what you do in order to be the best you can be for the boss. Mm-hmm. And you definitely, I don't, you know, and having said that, I don't want you to do it for me either.
Right.
I want to inspire you to be the best you can be at your work for your sake. Because I know 100% you're not going to be here forever.
Right.
But you may continue doing the same kind of work for a long time.
Yep.
And what matters is your reputation with the people that you interact with, not with me, not with the boss.
Yep.
But, you know, you're going to go on somewhere else and your reputation is going to follow you. If people know you for doing things the way, you know, this process, they might not invite you into their office. They might not have you back.
Why would they?
But if you do it in the way that comes most naturally to you,
yes.
You open the relationship, you work with clients, you provide your guidance, your intelligence, you bring your value to the process.
Yes.
And you do it for the sake of being the best you can be.
For
that
sure.
Will follow you, whatever your reputation is. If you're a hard driving salesperson, that reputation is going to follow you into the future.
Always.
For people who met you in the early days of your career, they might not ever want to see you if they don't like you. But if they don't like your process, but on the other hand, if you do things in a way that's comfortable and natural, and the same outcome evolves from that.
Yep.
Then by all means, do it your way.
Humans gravitate towards a common enemy.
Yeah.
And that will follow you. If you're shitty, especially if you stay in the same industry, if you're perceived as a shitty leader in one, it's going to follow you. Just to close out the buddy thing, you know, respect and popularity, they don't go hand in hand and they don't need to. As a leader, our job isn't to be everyone's friend. It's to help your team grow, even when it's uncomfortable. And that's the part that gets missed, that the leaders who want to be buddy-buddy forget. They don't want to deal with the uncomfortableness. They want to skirt it over, because leadership isn't a likability contest. It's everyone. If everyone is smiling around you all the time, then chances are they're not being honest. And that's something to reflect on. As a leader, as an employee, it will help you determine the barometer of where you currently are if this is a line of thinking you've never engaged in before.
Very profound conversation, Mark.
Thank you. Likewise.
So, well, you're actually leading. You're actually leading the conversation. You have provoked this in me. So Mark, if an advisor's listening right now, thinking, "Wow, you know, Jesus, this is way too accurate." What's the first step to fixing it? You know, before they lose team members, clients, and perhaps their credibility.
Well, they have to look in the mirror. There's no question. You know, I could say read a series of books that might help you determine and help your ability to look in the mirror and really focus on, you know, what illusions are you holding? What are the shadows that you cast when you walk out of the room with a team of employees? You know, focusing on, you know, are you a shame builder or do you actually listen and pay attention with your teams at the right time in the right place? You know, if you're not focusing on what your team needs, so I say, welcome to leadership. It's no longer about you. If you're not thinking that way, then you're not leading. You're managing your own image. And that's a big difference, massive difference. So I would say, to answer your direct question on what would be the first step for anyone listening, self-reflect. If anything we talked about today made you cringe, that's a sign. Because think about it. If you are a shitty leader and you don't know it, your ego is hating everything you've listened to right now. So your ego is going to try to convince you. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Don't listen to him. But if there's a piece of that that you're fighting and you're leaning into it and going, oh, I wonder, your ego's having a panic attack, but you're then sitting there going, maybe there's something here I should explore. So it's a self, it's a self-proclaimed internal struggle with knowing when to tell your ego to shut up.
This conversation turned out to be far deeper than I imagined. And
I tend to have that effect on people.
You know, well, it's not hard to see why. So Mark, where can folks find you?
www.shittyleaders.ca. Everything there.
Great.
Link
great,
the book.
Great website URL.
It's you know what? Yeah. It's clear and to the point, and that's why we're here. You know, yeah. There's a touch of humor, touch of dry sarcasm, wit. But at the end of the day, you know, we're not here to mess around and placate bad behavior. You know, if you're willing to look in the mirror and all of a sudden, like, you can't unhear what's been said. You can try to forget about it, but it's still going to be in there. And as things start to emerge, you're going to start to see things a little differently and hear things a little differently. And at that point, you're like, oh, God, maybe I need to do something different. And yeah, that's when the magic happens. It's about change. It's not about shame. It's not about blame. It's about people helping people to get to that level where all of this, whether you're advisor or not, whatever your leadership role is in this world, these things will trickle outside of work. It will trickle back home. It will trickle down in your relationships. It will trickle down to when you're in the car, stuck on the highway, and you're screaming at cars that aren't moving. It will trickle down to everything where you're like, do I need to spend time on this right now? Or can I move on and just live my life and be authentically me? And that's really what, you know, as a planet, I hope that we're inspiring to do more of sooner rather than later, because everyone knows we need it more now than ever.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
My pleasure.
It's been terrific having you.
Likewise. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.